Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, March the 28th. And it's time for the Friday Week in Review, when we talk with two guests from different perspectives about all of the news of the week, or at least the most significant news of the week. And we welcome your input, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What happened in politics this week that you want to talk about? We welcome your calls as we talk with our two guests. We have in studio with us today, Owen Robinson.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks very much for coming into studio today.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're usually over in the West Bend area. You're a columnist for the West Bend Daily News and a blogger for bootsandsabers.com. Ruth Conniff is on the telephone with us. She is political editor of the Progressive magazine. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
Well, let's start talking presidential campaign politics. Here's former President Bill Clinton from earlier this week.
I've already had four people come up to me and say, tell her not to quit. And I want to tell you something. My family's not big on quitting. You probably noticed that.
So, Ruth Conniff, should Hillary Clinton bow out of this race?
Well, something's got to happen sometime soon. I mean, it's getting more and more destructive for the Democrats. And it seems nearly impossible for her to get the nomination at this point. She's got, you know, some people judge a 5% chance, depending on how you look at the superdelegates. Her big hope of getting a revote in Florida and Michigan seems to be going by the boards. So Howard Dean came to town this week to talk about this with Democrats and progressives and some big Democratic Party donors who really want to know, is he going to solve this problem? And, of course, some people hold him responsible for the problem because by penalizing Florida and Michigan and taking away their votes when they move their primaries up early, he's created this really gray situation. And, you know, it just looks like more and more of a mess. I think my sense from hearing him speak, from talking to other people, is that Hillary is not going to stop, as Bill just said, until it's absolutely clear to her that she's not going to win. And, you know, when is that going to happen? It's going to grind on, and I think the negativity in the campaign, which continues to damage the Democrats, is going to grind on.
Yeah, this is hurting the Democrats and helping John McCain, isn't it, Owen Robinson?
Oh, I think so, and I agree with Ruth that it is very damaging for the Democrats, and it's helping John McCain right now, which is why Hillary should stay in right through to the convention and fight it out. But I think Ruth's right. Right now, it's mathematically almost impossible, not completely, but almost impossible for Hillary to gain the nomination. However, if you look at the pledged delegates, Obama can't seal it up either by convention. Either way, it's going to go to the superdelegates, and that's where it's going to rest. So we have this quirky little non-democratic process for the Democratic convention that may decide who their nominee is.
Yeah, the governor of Tennessee is proposing like a super delegate meeting in June after the last primary to wrap it up then before the convention. Is that a good idea, Ruth Conniff?
It seems like a, you know, viable idea. They have to come up with something. And by that time, it should be pretty easy for everybody to put their cards on the table and look at, you know, where does each candidate stand in terms of the popular vote. Bill Clinton has intimated that it's pretty hard to keep going forward and argue if you're not winning the popular vote that the superdelegates should vote for you and that you should, you know, you should be the nominee. So I think it's a perfectly good idea. You know, Barbara Lawton made an interesting point when Howard Dean was in town that she thinks he is well positioned to broker some kind of deal by talking to the campaigns, you know, hopefully before we get right up to the convention or the month before the convention, because he understands what it's like to be a presidential candidate and the sort of the maniacal focus, the years of work and the, you know, difficult ego issues in terms of letting go of your campaign. And, you know, how do you manage that and get people to step down? It's actually very difficult to do.
Well, and I think that Hillary right now is in a position that how she thinks she can win is by making this argument that she's been making for many months now, that she can win the big swing states. She can win the Floridas and the she's hoping Pennsylvania's and the Ohio's of the world, or of the U.S., where Obama can't, where he hasn't won in those big hotly contested, high delegate count states. And she's been making that argument for some months, and it really hasn't gotten any traction up until Obama's pastor flap over the past couple weeks, where now there's a lot within the Democratic Party and within the population looking at it, and party elders saying, you know, if this kind of stuff does become saturated into the general election, Obama will really struggle in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida.
Yeah. What about that pastor flap, Ruth Conniff?
Obama survived it. I mean, I think it's interesting because the polls this last week have shown that he bounced back and that Hillary's negatives are higher than ever. And she tried to revive it then by bringing it up again when she had to deal with her own flap about whether she was running from snipers in Bosnia or listening to a poem read by an 8-year-old girl. It's easy to see how you could, you know, confuse one with the other. So she had to answer questions about that really embarrassing comment that she made, and she tried to then change the subject immediately to Pastor Wright and say that she would resign from any church where, you know, a pastor said what Wright said. The truth of the matter is, I think the race speech, which I'm sure was the major topic last week, was really a dramatic response to that pastor flap, and Obama took us where no politician has taken us before, which is, you know, into the adult world and talk to people about, yes, this is, race is a big issue in our country, and there are some really angry people, and we need to get past this, and we need to be able to confront the reality of the situation. I think in that non-pandering speech, and what the polls have shown since then, he may have really broken new ground against that kind of negative smear.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think he may have survived it for the nomination process, but this will resurface during the general. And I don't think it's so much about the race issue with that. I think it becomes a patriotism issue for Obama, where it's this trickle effect. You had first Obama wouldn't wear the flag lapel pin. Then you have Michelle Obama talking about how she's never been proud of this country until now. And now we find out that they've been going to a church for 20 years where the pastor regularly asks, you know, God to damn America.
Wow.
Those are, and meanwhile, on the other side, you're going to have John McCain, decorated war hero, POW. It's a stark contrast that Obama really needs to watch. And if he's going to pull out a victory, you know, people want their president to love America. They want their president to be patriotic. It's not something that people are going to look over very lightly.
I think that's right. I think it's true that that's the struggle that he will face in the general election as a nominee against McCain. And these are the, you know, the kinds of things that have been floating about him, not just those examples, but also the really scurrilous stuff about his being a Muslim and, you know, being sworn in on the Quran. And, you know, there's a narrative that people try to put together, his middle name, to really try to cast aspersions, some lies and some true. But what's interesting about Obama is the degree to which he doesn't run from these attacks, but actually tries to look people in the eye and talk about, you know, what does this stuff really mean? What does patriotism really mean? And, you know, it'll be very interesting. I'll be very interested to see that race if, in fact, that's the race that we get. On the Pastor Wright thing, I think that people should watch. You know, I only watched this week the full text of that post-9/11 sermon. It is really worth seeing the whole thing in context. The fact that quote about the chickens coming home to roost is not him saying that in his words, but, in fact, quoting those words, actually twice quoting them, from an American diplomat quoting Malcolm X, you know, and the context of it is very sympathetic to the victims of 9/11, and it is not the angry, you know, down with America speech that it looks like from that little clip. I really urge people to watch it on YouTube. It's really worth seeing.
Neither of you think that this issue, the pastor issue, and Obama is going to hurt him when it comes to superdelegates convention time, thinking that this has hurt him so much he's not going to win the general election, so therefore superdelegates cast their votes for Hillary Clinton.
What do you got to weigh, you know, that against, you know, Hillary Clinton's frontline military experience in Bosnia? You know, how's that going to play against John McCain? I mean, she's really setting him up there for a, you know, for a home run.
Well,
so,
but she is also in a position where she was the first lady, where she has countless examples of her in patriotic, American-loving type situations, whereas, you know, I kind of want to go back to what you mentioned earlier about, you know, Obama being willing to sit down and confront issues and stuff. Not really. He didn't really confront the right issue, which has really been out there for months now before it hit the mainstream. He didn't confront it until his poll numbers dropped. Then he made the speech. It wasn't something where he stood up and took it on right when it came up. And when you talk about he wants to have a conversation about what patriotism means, John McCain doesn't have to have that conversation. Patriotism is sitting in a POW cell for years on end.
You know, I also wanted to ask you both about a poll that came out this week that showed about 30% of Hillary Clinton supporters saying that they would vote for John McCain before they would vote for Barack Obama if Barack Obama gets the nomination. Somewhat similar situation with Obama supporters, about 20% of them saying they would vote for McCain rather than Hillary Clinton if Hillary Clinton got the nomination. That's kind of troubling, isn't it, Ruth Conniff?
Yeah, I think this is the damage that Hillary is doing by talking about herself and McCain as being the two competent potential presidents, you know, not Obama. I mean, that's sort of unprecedented in party politics to say that, you know, the other party's nominee would be better than my opponent, the likely nominee of my party. So I think that's a real problem. I think that just the acrimony, I don't know if those voters are going to go to the polls and actually vote for John McCain, given the stark difference between both of the Democrats and McCain. I mean, you know, patriotism to McCain is staying in Iraq for 100 years. I mean, we've seen the kind of, you know, empty flag-waving and militarism that Bush has projected over the last 8 years and where that's gotten our country. So I think there are many, many Americans, a majority of Americans, who don't agree that being manipulated by the, you know, the words about patriotism into this endless, disastrous war is where we want to go in the future in this country.
Well, bearing in mind that Bush was elected president twice using that rhetoric, so obviously it works. As for this poll, I agree with you, Ruth. This is the damage that Clinton is doing to the Democratic Party, and it's not necessarily, I think, that those voters may go over and actually vote for McCain, but they may sit home, and that would be a huge blow. And when we're having elections that are decided by less than 5 points, having, you know, 20% of your base sit home is not a good thing for any candidate.
I don't think at the end that the whole Democratic base or a large portion of Democrats are going to sit home. I think it's going to be the Republicans who have trouble getting people to the polls. They're the ones who had trouble getting people enthusiastic about voting this year. As Arnold Schwarzenegger put it, you know, they just don't get the box office because they don't have the people in the seats. You know, Republicans are discouraged. And I think Democrats are energized like never before. The real tragedy here is if they end up having to deal with such a bitter battle that's sort of squandered. But I think in the end, when you look at the crowds that are coming out for the candidates, when you look at the historic voter turnout in the primaries, it's really, I think that's a wave that's going to keep on cresting.
Do you think, Ruth, first, that Hillary Clinton wants Barack Obama to lose to John McCain so she can run in 2012?
Well, this is the real conspiracy theory. I mean, this is what, you know, people who are really in the tank for Obama suspect. They suspect that the Clintons are so craven that they would rather set Hillary up for her next presidential run by losing this election. And I don't think that that's her plan. I think that Hillary's plan is just to do whatever it takes for as long as it takes. And as Owen says, you know, continue to slime Obama and wear people down until he's just so damaged that somehow she's able to get in there. You know, I think that's her strategy, is to get elected this time.
And I would agree. I heard somebody refer to that as the Tanya Harding effect for Hillary to take out Obama. But I agree. I think Hillary has been gearing up for this presidential run for 20 years. And she cannot she cannot personally accept the fact that she may not even get her party's nomination. And I think that until she can mentally get over that hurdle, she's going to be in this race tooth and nail fighting, because that's what the Clintons do.
We are talking with Owen Robinson. He's a blogger for bootsandsabers.com, a columnist for the West Bend Daily News, and Ruth Conniff, who is political editor of the Progressive Magazine, our two guests this week for The Week in Review. 1-800-642-1234, in Madison 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, John Munson in for Ben Marins. And after four, it's your views on the news. You're invited to call in to talk about what you think is the most significant news story of the week when John Munson talks with his guest about your views on the news after 4 o'clock this afternoon. This is The Week in Review. We talk with two guests from different perspectives every Friday at this time about the news of the week. And today, Owen Robinson and Ruth Conniff are our guests. And our first caller is Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I would just like to agree with Owen. I think that this Jeremiah Wright pastor thing is going to be huge in the general election, much greater than anything that Hillary has done. Hillary's been pretty well vetted. And I think also that in Pennsylvania, you may be very surprised at Hillary's victory. You know, all the Starbucks crowd and those Obama supporters are doing well now, but you take some out-of-work steel workers in Pennsylvania who, you know, the Clintons have been very good to. I think there's going to be a big victory. I don't think Hillary's done yet.
Mm-hmm. Ruth Conniff?
Well, I don't know that the Clintons have been particularly good to the out-of-work steel workers. I mean, after all, it was the Clintons who brought us NAFTA, and Hillary's supposed opposition to the contrary notwithstanding. You know, her first lady records that were finally released show that she, in fact, did lobby for NAFTA's passage. So, you know, she does make this case, though, and she does make it well, and she does sound more populist in some ways, particularly throughout the upper Midwest and, you know, talking to workers about things like health care, the mortgage crisis. I mean, I think that's right. I think that she probably does stand to do well in Pennsylvania. It's the next last stop. You know, it was Texas and Ohio, and now it's Pennsylvania. And that it may be that she does well there.
Well, and I think that I think you're largely right, Frank. I think she's going to do very well in Pennsylvania. But looking at the actual delegate counts, that doesn't, you know, it's a net gain of maybe a dozen delegates. It doesn't get her there. What it does give her is, again, underline the argument she's making that she can win the big, diverse swing states. Also, I think if you look look towards North Carolina, when that comes in, that's going to be a key state for her as well. If she can walk out saying, look, I can win in North Carolina in the South, I can win in Pennsylvania and, you know, in Union territory, I can win in Ohio, a diverse state. Why can't Obama win these states? I think that's a valid argument she can make to superdelegates that will resonate with a lot of them.
Yeah. Mary in Madison is with us now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I would like to ask you how to refocus the media. I am so tired of the sniping. I don't care who was under sniper fire. I don't care what church Obama goes to. I don't care about that. I want to hear about what are they going to do about the weak dollar? What are they going to do about health care? What are they going to do about the fact that the largest civilian contractor has moved their headquarters to Dubai out of the United States? What are they going to do about loss of jobs? This is what I care about. I don't care about the other stuff. And the media picks up on all these little things, and they never talk about the real issues.
Yeah.
Well, one, because the real issues are boring and don't sell well. But in truth, Mary, you should care about some of those issues. Because when you're electing a president, you're electing them. You're electing the person. You need to know the content of their character, because you don't know what they're going to face. When we elected Bush in 2000, we had no idea 9/11 was coming. When we elected Kennedy, we had no idea the Cuba Missile Crisis was coming. But you look for these clues, these insights into their character, how they run their real life. I mean, it seems pretty clear that Hillary Clinton is a liar. And that's important to know. when you're electing a president, because it lets you evaluate that person to decide if they should be your president and represent your nation.
There's a ringing defense of the celebrity gossip form of journalism that we're seeing in the campaign. I mean, the candidates themselves, of course, manipulate that penchant for the easily understood, you know, the sex scandal, the personality stuff, the popularity contest, because people, it's easy to understand, and it's, you know, frankly kind of hard to sit down and try to understand the mortgage crisis. So that is part of the reason. I mean, I think we have an increasingly mind-numbing television media, but this information is available, and the candidates gave major speeches this week mm-hmm. on these issues, you know, so I think you can see adequate coverage of the candidates' positions on these issues to make a judgment.
But truth be told, for the most part, Clinton and Obama are very similar on their stands on the major issues. I mean, there's some, you know, minor differences, Ruth Conniff, but aren't they pretty much the same?
I would say that Clinton and Obama are very close to each other on, you know, in terms of the speeches that they gave this week on the mortgage crisis and on the, you know, the crisis in the whole credit crunch. But their difference from McCain is very stark if you look at mm-hmm. his speech on the home mortgage crisis.
Well, and I think it's interesting that, and we're seeing some ripple effects from the drawn-out primary season that we're having on the Democrat side of the aisle, where, you know, they're having to make major policy speeches now. Normally that stuff doesn't happen till the general. They're, you know, so it's really going to lock the when Obama or possibly long shot Hillary get the nomination, it robs them of the opportunity to move back to the middle for the general election, because they're already out there with firm policy stances. So it's going to make the general election that much more interesting. There was that article out, I believe it was in the Times this week, saying that perhaps, you know, at the convention, they should do away with both candidates and go with Al Gore. That could be interesting as well. If they abandon a historic female or African-American candidacy for yet another white guy.
That's just not going to happen, though. That's just not going to happen. Hey, how do you explain, then, John McCain staking out the territory to the far, far right? I mean, he has no opponent now in the primary, and yet in his home mortgage speech, he went one better than George Bush and said, we should just deregulate the entire financial industry. We got to just, you know, throw the whole thing up in the air. I mean, that's, even Republicans find that a little bit out there.
Well, I agree that, I will disagree that McCain is far, far right, but he is on some issues further to the right than Bush, which is true. The interesting thing that the Democrats are going to have problems with McCain are is that he is further to the right on some issues, on the Iraq War, on national defense, on monetary policy, on those kinds of things. He is further to the right than Bush. On the other hand, he talks up things like global warming and these other left issues that it will really rob the Democrat candidate of being able to campaign on those issues.
Yeah. This week saw the milestone of 4,000 U.S. troops dead in the fighting in Iraq. Yesterday, President Bush gave a speech on the success of the surge in Iraq, and in the meantime, the violence is escalating in Iraq. Let me go to Marty in Green Bay to talk about this. Marty? Marty, are you there? Well, thanks, Marty. Let me get Ruth Conniff to talk about all this. What does this mean? He wanted to know what this was going to mean for the presidential election. Do you have any ideas, Ruth?
Well, it continues to be an issue. I think, you know, Bush's commitment to keep troop levels pretty much the same means that his successor is going to have to deal with the mess that he's made in Iraq. That's not going to be dealt with. You know, it's going to, in fact, be peaking right in the heat of the general election campaign. So that's, you know, that's the political side. But it's also just an incredible milestone, the 4,000 U.S. soldiers dead. And just a shocking and appalling cost in human life of this debacle in Iraq. You know, we don't talk much about the 29,000 wounded or the 85,000 civilian deaths of Iraqis, up to a million maybe if you count collateral damage, the 3 million refugees. The, you know, appalling situation in Iraq. He says the surge is working even as the surge, the progress made under the surge is falling apart. And then, you know, just on the sort of grappling with the human scale and the tragic nature of the Iraq War, there were, you know, finally some human interest stories about these soldiers. There was a really moving piece in the New York Times with the letters home from some of the soldiers, all of whom are now dead, who were the last ones to take us to this 4,000 mark. It's a horrible tragedy. The majority of the public is dead set against it, and the only thing Dick Cheney has to say is so. So, you know, this is going to drive a lot of public opinion during the election, and this is where McCain is really nowhere. He's just supporting Bush's same failed policy.
Well, that's not quite true. McCain is supporting prosecuting the Iraq War to its conclusion till we have a stable and democratically elected Iraqi government that they can self-govern, that they can regulate their security. But he's also been a vocal opponent of Bush on many issues, from Guantanamo to waterboarding to McCain was an advocate of the surge when many people weren't. McCain was an advocate of firing Rumsfeld. So McCain has had sharply different views on, he supports the war, but has sharply different views on how to prosecute it. And I think if you look at one of the big mistakes, I think, that many, many pundits out there made in interpreting the 2006 elections was that it was a mandate to pull out of Iraq now. It doesn't appear it was. What it looks like it was a mandate to change what we are doing, to either fight it or get out. It's back to the Vietnam syndrome. It's, you know, either fight the war and win or get out, but stop doing what we're doing now.
Let me bring in a caller, Ned in Wausau. Hi, Ned.
Hi. I watched the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and he has an expert named Juan Cole, who knows Iraq very well. And he described the situation in Basra as having two militias fighting against each other, both siphoning off oil money. And one of them is backed by al-Sadr, who has a tremendous following in Iraq. And without al-Sadr's lukewarm support, al-Maliki would have never gotten elected. So if our goal is to have democracy in Iraq and a stable government, we've got real problems because the U.S. is now providing bombing support, air support for al-Maliki's forces, and it is the Iraqi forces that are fighting, taking the side of one of the two militias against the other militia.
That's right.
And that's a real problem, because then what we're really doing is backing a government that does not have majority support and will fall. I have no doubt that soon elections will be held. Al-Maliki will fall, and then we've got real problems because we made an enemy with a large number of people that follow al-Sadr.
Okay, let me get our guests in, Owen.
Well, I think you bring up a few things that are very important to notice. One, it is the Iraqi people who are prosecuting this battle. It is not American troops, except for logistics support and training. But here we have where 3 years ago those would have been American boots on the ground doing that. That shows progress. That shows that they are taking control of their own security. The other thing you mentioned is very, very likely true, that al-Maliki will lose support in the next election. In the next election. That is something that is key, having a democratically elected government. So, you know, these are you know, if you look back to our own history, after we had our nation, we had to go back and Washington had to crush some separatists in the Whiskey Rebellion. I mean, these things are the growing pains of a growing democratically elected government in a free nation.
You know, this is the kind of spin that we've been hearing in Iraq from the beginning. The fact is we're now refereeing a civil war, Shia versus Shia, which is exactly where we don't want to be in Iraq. You know, the U.S. troops are very heavily involved. There was an NPR piece right before we came on, you know, talking about the degree to which U.S. troops are crucial to what's going on currently. Yes, the Iraqi forces are out front in Basra, but the U.S. troops are absolutely crucial and are heavily involved there. So the civil war that's going on, I think the caller is absolutely right, and the battle between al-Sadr's forces and the government soldiers of Maliki really it's the splitting apart for the first time, really, of the Shia community in Iraq. It portends a long and brutal battle. And there's a piece in the New York Times today that talks about how people in Basra really believe that the Maliki forces are there to try to shut down the Sadr forces before the provincial elections, that this is about local politics. And the U.S. is just completely sucked into this mess.
Well, and here, you know, and I appreciate, Ruth, that you opposed the war and you didn't want to go in there, and that's fine. It's a principled position. But the reality is we are there, and it always comes back to what do we do now? Fine.
Right.
We're refereeing a civil war, if I can see that point, which I don't. But what if we pull out? Will that make it better? Will that destabilize the region? Will it make oil prices go to $2.50 a barrel?
I think it's bad. You know, we made a real mess. So the question is, you know, right, what do we do? And is what we are doing making things better? You know, the argument that it's making things better right now depends on your belief that the surge has been successful. The surge, and really it's the ceasefire that al-Sadr called that has contributed significantly to the drop in violence during the surge. That's falling apart now, and the U.S. continues to be, you know, stuck in the mud. If you look at McCain's foreign policy speech this week, I agree with your earlier point about his, you know, there's sort of hopeful signs with McCain when he comes out against torture, when he talks about wanting to close Guantanamo. But then when he talks about Iraq, he points to signs of what he calls progress, and they're very dubious. And he says we've got to stay there because we've got to fight al-Qaeda. And as we know, you know, from the news last week, he's not really clear on who al-Qaeda is allied with in Iraq, how that fits into the whole picture of the war there. So I think it's a pretty flimsy case that the Bush administration and McCain make for their plan to reach what they call victory. What's victory?
Victory is a stable Iraq with a democratically elected
government. And we're nowhere near
that.
In fact, we're devolving into greater chaos.
We have other issues to cover and time running short, so let me remind listeners, this is The Week in Review, talking with Ruth Conniff, who is political editor of The Progressive Magazine, and Owen Robinson, who is blogger with bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. We welcome your thoughts on the news of the week. We're going to talk a little bit about China and Tibet when we come back after this break, and also cover some state news as well. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn today, talking with her guests about how activists want to shake up the Olympics in Beijing. They're using the phrase Genocide Olympics, and you'll find out more about that coming up after 9 o'clock. This is the Friday Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Ruth Conniff and Owen Robinson. And our next caller is Steve in Fish Creek. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'm concerned about, you know, I'm going to present a completely contrarian viewpoint on Tibet. Having lived in China for 6 months, I learned history that I had never heard before. But whenever the media seems to talk about Tibet, the only historical conflict they ever mention is in 1949 when Mao reclaimed the region as part of China. And sometimes they mention 1959 when the Dalai Lama fled China after the failure of an armed rebellion. But before 1959, the majority of Tibetan people were dominated and suppressed under a social order that probably was far more cruel and reactionary than serfdom in Europe in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Not only did the monasteries and the aristocracy own all the arable land and the pastures, as well as the majority of the livestock in the country, but if you wanted an education for your daughter in Tibet, there was zero.
Yeah,
none.
So, Steve, I'm sorry, I'm not sure we have time for a real long history lesson, so your point is?
The point is that the history of Tibet is unknown by the people who are supporting the Dalai Lama. He is basically out to return Tibet to this form of religious political domination that existed before.
Yeah. Ruth, is that what's going on?
That's really not my impression. I mean, the really bloody crackdown by China and Tibet, I think it's hard to argue that the Tibetans are better off under Chinese rule. And the Dalai Lama is actually not for separating entirely.
Right.
He's not for independence. He's just for more autonomy for Tibet. So you know, given the brutality of Chinese occupation of Tibet, I think it truly is a contrarian view to say that, you know, the Dalai Lama would be a more oppressive ruler for the Tibetans.
But I think what we're seeing with the Tibet crackdown and with the upcoming Olympics and all the controversy over that is people are remembering what China is. It's an oppressive communist regime that, you know, not too long ago was wholesale massacring millions of people. And now they're quieter about it. But, you know, there is people are remembering the thing. This isn't the big cuddly China that makes our toys for us full of lead. But this is a totalitarian regime. And this is what totalitarian regimes do. They oppress people.
And it's the, you know, owner of a lot of our currency and the massive, you know, global economic force that it is. And that's why the U.S. is dealing with China.
Yeah. The latest news in Nepal, about 18 Tibetan exiles have scaled the walls of the United Nations compound in the capital, protesting China's crackdown on violence in Tibet. Hundreds of others protested outside the compound. So these uprisings, the violence is continuing over these Tibetans who are protesting China's rule. Where's this headed, Ruth? Is anything going to come of this?
Well, I think that the international community has been aware of the situation in Tibet for a long time. This is a moment when it's really coming much more to public attention, in part because of the upcoming Olympics. And you know, there's a grassroots effort to get some action by the other nations of the world to really try to pressure China. And China is, you know, I pretty much agree with how Owen describes China. It's hard to see them yielding, but that's what has to happen. That's what the Dalai Lama believes will happen. Ultimately, the Chinese people and the Chinese government, you know, will see the light on this issue.
I agree with Ruth. I think that the Chinese will crush the Tibetans. They will kill the leaders, and the world will forget.
Well, I don't know if that's how I'm going to put it. I'm going to say something a little more hopeful than that, which is that, you know, that this is a struggle, that this is a basic struggle for justice that's really touched people throughout the world and political leaders and citizens alike. And the Dalai Lama is, you know, enormously affecting character, and the nations of the world should really get behind him and fight for the rights of the Tibetan people and pressure China as hard as they can and do that in a pragmatic and intelligent way to put economic pressure on the government. You know, the threats over the Olympics, I suspect, are not going to go that far. But, you know, I think that that's a struggle for justice. And as evil as the Chinese regime has showed itself to be, I think that's important to continue.
Well, and as a quick tangent on this point, I saw on TV yesterday Nancy Pelosi, Jim Sensenbrenner, and the Dalai Lama all sitting together. I'd love to know what they were talking about.
That's an odd shot, isn't it? Yeah, we're going to move on to some state issues, including the race for state Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin. There's a debate this week. There's another debate tonight. In fact, let me plug that. At 7 o'clock tonight, it's the We the People Wisconsin debate. It's going to be at 7 o'clock. You can watch it on Wisconsin Public Television or listen to it on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, featuring the incumbent justice, Lewis Butler, debating his challenger, Burnett County Circuit Court Judge Michael Gableman. So probably, I think, the last debate before the April 1st election. Let me go to Roberto in Green Bay, who wants to talk about the race. Hi, Roberto. You're on the air.
Hi, Joy. You're awesome. My question is, what do you do about guys like Gableman who want to be a true activist judge and political action committees representing or are running campaigns for judges that should be impartial?
All right. Well, certainly Judge Gableman calls himself the judicial conservative in this race. He accuses Lewis Butler, the incumbent justice, as being the judicial activist. Apparently, Roberto doesn't agree with that assessment. Owen Robinson, you want to start?
Right. Well, I'm not sure where your evidence base is for that Gableman would be an activist judge. What we do know is that Butler has been an activist judge in his current position. He's the incumbent. He has a record that we can look at. So we see that. As far as other groups getting involved, it's happening on both sides, whether you like it or not. You have the Greater Wisconsin Committee has spent the most right now in favor of Butler or against Gableman, however you look at it. Just this week, we saw WEAC come out with a statewide campaign, television campaign, attacking Gableman. There's clearly both sides, and you can tell why. This is an incredibly important race, probably the most important Supreme Court race we've had in decades, because it has the potential to actually change the balance of the court. Right now, it's dominated by a majority of judicial liberals, judicial activists, and it's the opportunity to change it to a court with a majority of judicial conservatives. Now, that's not to say, Butler is a smart guy. He's a nice guy. He's a good man. He just has a different judicial philosophy than Gableman.
His philosophy is that we ought to uphold the Constitution, which Gableman obviously finds just appalling. I mean, the caller is right. Gableman is exactly the opposite of what he claims to be. He's the judicial activist. When you look at his ads, which are, both sides are doing it argument is so ridiculous, because Gableman's ads are so specious and so revolting that even Charlie Sykes and the Republican DA of Dodge County, who used to endorse Gableman and now pulled his endorsement, have spoken out against these lying ads that essentially tar Butler for applying the law and saying that, yes, if there's DNA evidence that shows that somebody did not commit a crime, or that the case that was built to convict them was full of holes, that person should get a new trial. The ad that they put on the air that Gableman himself, and I think it's important to understand that it's not third party groups, but the Gableman campaign itself that's putting the worst ads on the air, showing his Butler's picture next to the picture of the sex offender that he purportedly freed. Well, actually, the guy never went free, right? I mean, it's really appalling to see the lies coming out of the Gableman campaign. And this guy, what a backbencher he is. I mean, if Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce wanted to come up with somebody to run against Butler so that they could tilt the balance of the court, which I agree with Owen is what they're trying to do, couldn't they come up with somebody better than this guy? I mean, this guy is one of the most reversed judges in the state on appeal. The average judge is affirmed 81% of the time, Gableman 67%. He's a backbencher, he's completely dishonest, and he's put ads on the air that are so revolting that prominent Republicans in the state have had to come out and retract their endorsements and attack the guy.
Well, one endorsement, you can drop the plural there. But that ad was misleading, and it was called out by conservatives, including myself on my blog.
And yet Gableman to this day refuses to acknowledge.
And yet when the ads come out on the other side, I don't see the liberals over there in your camp stepping up to condemn
but
those
what
either.
Are those, okay, so, but what are those ads, Owen? The ads, Newsweek has followed this. It's interesting because they're really following these state judicial races now. And they carefully go through the misleading fundraising litter, the misleading television ad from the Gableman side, and then they go to the pro-Butler ads, again saying, okay, let's look at both sides. This is also, something that should be taken off the air. But they don't find that it's not true. They just find that it's
misleading.
They say it's true that McCallum appointed Gableman after he made a major contribution to McCallum, and it's true that it's very hard to see any other reason why he would have been appointed. Nonetheless, there's not hard evidence that that contribution to the McCallum campaign was the reason for the appointment. Well, that's a long way from just putting flat out lies on the air about criminals going free who never went free.
I think you're going to disappoint our caller, Mary, by focusing on the little issues and losing sight of the big one. Butler has weighed in on cases that have changed the law, that have made what the Wall Street Journal has said that is making Wisconsin become Alabama North because of our friendly trial environment. So, trial lawyers love Butler. If you love trial lawyers, vote for Butler.
Let me, because we're running short on time and still a couple of issues to go here. Owen, what is your, you know, your prediction, your assessment of this race? What do you think is going to happen on Tuesday?
I think it's interesting because we have two historical trends here that are going against each other. One is that sitting or incumbent justices hardly ever lose. I think the last time was 53 or something, a long time ago. The other trend that we have is every time we've had a contested Supreme Court race, the one that could portray themselves as a law and order candidate, whether you think he is or not, the one who the electorate mm-hmm. sees as a law and order candidate wins hands down. Wisconsinites like law and order judges. So if I were to predict it now, I think Gableman's going to win, but I think it's going to be real close.
What do you think, Ruth?
I think that Gableman is so slimy and has been exposed as being a liar. And I think because of that the people of Wisconsin are not going to vote for him. Besides which, Butler has the support of the five largest law enforcement organizations in the state. He is not the soft-on-crime judge that Gableman tries to suggest that he is in what are really now, I think, widely seen as completely false and misleading ads.
Listeners can watch or listen to the debate tonight and get more information if you want on this Supreme Court race, 7 o'clock tonight. What about this Frankenstein veto, a proposed constitutional amendment that's on the ballot on Tuesday? A lot of people surprised. They forgot that this was going to end up on the ballot. Any doubt that the citizens of Wisconsin are going to change the Constitution to limit a governor's partial veto power, Owen Robinson?
I have no doubt. Wisconsin's going to pass this overwhelmingly and do away with this veto. It's been a stain on our system for quite some time, and finally Fred Risser got out of the way and let it come to the ballot. This is something that Tommy Thompson abused. This is something that Doyle abused, and it's, if you believe in good government, we will amend our Constitution to do away with it.
Mm-hmm. Ruth?
I agree. When Thompson used it was called the Vanna White veto. I don't know how it morphed from Vanna White into Frankenstein, but it's fundamentally undemocratic. It's to the Democrats' advantage now. It was to the Republicans' advantage when Thompson used it, but basically it's just undemocratic.
Yeah, I think the Vanna White was the striking of just letters to make new words, and this is actually, you can't strike words from multiple sentences and then stitch them together to make new sentences.
Right. <You know>?
Yeah. Hey, this is there's not enough time to really talk about this in depth, but there's the investigation wrapping up today on possible charges against the Wausau, Wisconsin area parents who allowed their 11-year-old daughter to die. She had treatable diabetes, but apparently, allegedly, the parents wanted to pray for her. They didn't want to seek any medical intervention. The girl died. Apparently, under Wisconsin law, they may have the defense of using prayer in good faith as treatment. Brief reaction, Ruth Conniff.
It's a tragedy. It's really difficult legal issue. I would hate to see bad law come out of this tragedy, as often happens. I think that, you know, you have to balance the desire to keep government out of people's, you know, lives and to allow people to practice their faith against the well-being of children, and you don't want to see a child die. So I think just as, you know, in serious abuse and neglect cases, the state intervenes, there's got to be a standard by which the state can intervene if the child's life is in danger.
20 seconds, Owen? Sorry.
Well, I agree to a large extent. There are big issues at play here, big legal and civil rights conundrums to grapple with. I would say you have to look at these on a case-by-case basis, and in this case, the responsibility was to make sure that child lived, and we failed in that responsibility.
Thanks to both of you so much for being with us, Owen Robinson, Ruth Conniff. It's been a pleasure.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive Magazine. Owen Robinson, blogger for bootsandsabers.com. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.